Welcome back to Three Black Dots with Dr. Tiffany, Dr. Karen, and Dr. Zanetta.
So this past week, last week, August 1st, was Henrietta Lacks' birthday, and she would have been 100 on August 1st.
Oh, she would have been 100. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so on the Facebook site, we put something out on her birthday. And I guess it was a little bit, you know, of media attention about it again, because it would have been her 100th birthday. But the story of Henrietta Lacks, did you guys read the book? The Immortal Life?
I couldn't finish it. I could not finish
really?
It. And I tried. It. I promise. I promise I tried.
Too. Did not like the writing at all.
I think I ended up going to Wikipedia or something and just, I couldn't do it.
Well, I liked the book.
Yeah. No, it's I purchased it.
Yeah, I
have read it when I guess it came out about 10 years ago now. But anyway, and so it told the story of Henrietta Lacks. She was a woman in Baltimore who went in to get treated for advanced cervical cancer and unfortunately died shortly after at the age of only 31, you know, to die from cervical cancer. That's
terrible.
It's so striking to me, you know, just the advances that we made since then. But one of the reasons we made so many advances is because while she was there, her cells were taken and stored for research. And they found that her cells didn't die in culture for the first time. So she had the first immortal cell line in culture. And the story was so interesting because it was like her cells were being used for all kinds of research.
I mean, Nobel
biomedical
prizes.
Research. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this went on for 25 years until they found out that other cell lines that they thought were from other like cancers, prostate, breast, turned out to also be her cells, which are called HeLa cells for Henrietta Lacks, H-E-L-A, HeLa cells. And so they were trying to figure out, kind of separate out which ones were HeLa cells and which ones were other types. And that's how they contacted the family.
Which is egregious.
The family's DNA.
Right.
To try to figure out.
Sort out, which is what.
Sort it out. And that's how they found out that they had her cells growing in culture for those 25 years. And in that time, I mean, those cells have been, you know, sold by companies. People have profited, mm-hmm. right? They've been used in cancer research, vaccine research, polio vaccine research, you know, IVF research.
So what's fascinating is that her cells weren't even used to really look at cervical cancer, right? So
right.
A lot of the research wasn't even done around cervical cancer, because when I was in the lab, y'all know I've spent however many years getting mm-hmm. my PhD, I used HeLa cells all mm-hmm. the time and had no idea
yeah.
what that stood
mm-hmm.
for.
Isn't that crazy?
You know, isn't it crazy? Like,
and I remember asking, like, what is this for? And other people didn't know, and they should have known by then.
Not necessarily.
You know?
I don't know. Like, so when was this? What year was this, Z?
So, this would have been early 2000s.
Yeah. So, I mean, the
yeah.
book came out, what, 2010, maybe?
2010, about 10 years
fair
ago.
Enough.
Yeah.
Fair
so,
enough. Fair enough, yeah.
Really the... You know, because again, I think it was not hidden, but and there obviously people mm-hmm. knew, but I really think it was that book made it more public. And that's where you started to get the groundswell of saying, look, so many people have profited. There's been amazing research and the family has gotten nothing. And these cells were taken without her permission. That's the biggest thing.
Right.
And I know we were talking a little bit about clinical trials earlier, and that's, you know, I don't know. Again, this would have been tissue that would have been tossed away
mm-hmm.
or perhaps looked at under a microscope and stored. But still, if there's going to be something that's going to be looked at and researched beyond that, there really needs to be informed consent around that. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. this was before the time where, mm-hmm. number one, they didn't think
right.
she's Black. She's a Black woman. Right. Henrietta Lacks was Black.
Right.
And I'm sure there were probably people who didn't think that she deserved to have any say so in her care.
Right. And sadly, it was the norm.
Yeah. This was 1951.
Yeah.
You know, that's when things were all segregated. And
Hopkins was that's where the Black people went.
Yeah.
To me, it's fascinating to consider how much has changed since then. You know, just like you're saying, Karen, just the idea that, like, you could take cells and nobody even know until really a fluke, you know, 25 years later. I mean, I think it speaks to what has been put in place now when you are conducting research in terms of making sure that everything is reviewed by an institutional review board and that, you know, people have informed consent and that you really have these safeguards up to protect patients, you know, to protect people from this happening, right?
Well, let's be clear. I mean, the people who took her cells and the people who were growing the HeLa cells in culture knew exactly where they came from. Mm-hmm. The only thing that happened in terms of her family being notified is that there was some cells that were contaminated.
Right.
There were cell lines that were contaminated.
And they wanted their DNA to help sort it out.
That's how the family found out about it. But, you know, again, that they've known where they've come from. That's
because they were able to contact the family.
Right. But also because they were named HeLa, so they were named after her.
And so they were named after her.
They knew exactly where they were from. It's just literally researchers like, oh, there's something's not right. Let's go talk to her family. But that's how her family was notified, which is cray, you know?
Yeah.
So much that's been, you know, that those cells have contributed so deeply to so much research. I mean, so much research. You know, but what's funny is that you talked about how young she was. Not funny, but interesting. Talk about how far we've come.
Yeah.
And our very first podcast was talking about HPV vaccine.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Cervical cancer
yep.
is caused from HPV.
Yep.
And there has been a lot that's been learned about cervical cancer where that used to kill young women, you know,
yes.
it would kill Black women and kill other women, cervical cancer. And we don't see that. The numbers of women mm-hmm. who have cervical cancer in the country has declined, as has the deaths from cervical cancer in the country has declined, simply because, you know, we now know kind of what the causative agent is.
Mm-hmm.
We've come far because of research, but it just has to be done in the right way.
Right. But that's one of the things that, you know, I love about medicine is that, you know, you can think about how quickly things move, you know, and things change and we can intervene and make a difference. Like, you know, you mentioned that we talked about the cervical cancer vaccine in one of our first episodes, which now was what, I don't know, 2 months ago, maybe. And even since then, that vaccination has gotten another FDA indication, right, for head and neck cancer. So I think when we talked about in that episode, HPV being a virus, you know, that can cause cervical and head and neck cancer. At the time we were talking about it, the vaccination was only approved to prevent cervical cancer. That's since expanded in the last month to also say, yeah, we have enough proof to say that it also can prevent head and neck cancers, which are associated with the same virus. And so, you know, there's just another example of how quickly things change in medicine. And especially in cancer, how much progress we've seen. You know, mm-hmm. the idea that someone who is 31 would die from a cervical cancer to me is like, ugh.
Yeah.
You know, you almost can't even fathom it. And it is one of the cancers now where you have screening. Right. Screening guidelines that start early on. I think they start at 25 for cervical cancer now.
Actually, they start 3 years after your first sexual encounter.
It used to be that. We'll look it up. Yeah.
What do you mean? The HPV vaccine?
No.
Yeah. I thought it starts way earlier than that. Yeah. It's in your teens.
A lot of it's dependent on when you start having sex.
Exactly.
But you know, I think we can certainly look that up and verify, but that was actually interesting because, you know, I mentioned our podcast, as I mentioned, we had our A4C meeting, the North Carolina Advisory Committee on Cancer Coordination and Control. Our meeting was today. And as you guys know, I kind of lead the section on prevention. And so we had one of our members was talking about the HPV, so human papillomavirus, and because that's a huge area, right? The Centers for Disease Control has this program called BSEP, which is around kind of breast cancer and cervical cancer control and, you know, the guidelines and making sure people mm-hmm. are aware. But we have primary care doctors who are like, I just can't keep up. Like, things change so fast, you know, to Tiffany's point. And so this is why, you know, people were like, oh, well, let's write a book chapter. How about we not? Because by the time that book chapter comes out,
and
the
it's book, too late. Book
comes out, it's too late. Everything
it's
is
changed. Too late.
And so that's why kind of these sorts of opportunities where we can use social media and podcasts and try to get information out sooner is really important. And I've always said my desire was to create a platform for the dissemination of timely and accurate information into the Black community, because timely is important. When these things are changing so rapidly, when these guidelines are changing, when the indications are changing mm-hmm. so rapidly, you know, how do we get the information out to communities? The only way is if we're literally have a, some form of communication where we can deliver that information. Because that change for the FDA just happened last month, right? That in terms of for head and neck cancers. Right, Tiff?
Yeah. Yeah, it was like a month. Well, we're in August now. So yeah, it was right. June. Yeah.
Right.
It was June. So that is in between when we talked about it on right. our podcast, which is brand new, that just started.
Right.
And now.
Right. And a lot of us also think that it could right? prevent anal cancer as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right. I think we're waiting, just kind of waiting on that to happen so. As well. Mm-hmm. But back to the cervical cancer screening guidelines, I just pulled it up.
Yep.
It's 21. I think I thought it was earlier than that, but it looks like all of the professional organizations are saying 21.
Yeah, it used to be determined based on when your first sexual encounter was.
That's what I thought.
There's an idea that your body could naturally clear it, I think.
I see.
I think there's always the idea that the body can naturally clear, but that's interesting. Yeah. It says for average risk women, so I wonder what a high risk woman would be considered.
And here's
so America's changed. So,
well, an American Cancer Society is 25.
It's 25. Yes. Fascinating.
Yeah. Uh huh.
Yeah. So this goes to
25 every 5 years. Yep.
Importance of having conversations with your doctor to talk about what your risks are. Mm-hmm. But I think there's no, you know, my thing is if you're concerned, you know,
you need to get it's yeah, get it done.
You know, because that's the thing. I mean, you see, and I'll have to look at the data. I haven't looked at the data recently for immigrant populations, but what we were seeing is cervical cancer amongst young women for immigrants. And part of it is because they weren't tested and they don't know about screening. And so that's part of the education that happens with newly immigrant populations that needs to happen from a health, you know, standpoint and population health standpoint is to actually have those conversations around different types of screening and how to utilize the healthcare system in the United States, that sort of thing. But I'll have to look and see. I thought Hispanic women, there was a relatively high incidence of cervical cancer amongst young women. But like I said, it's been a long time since I've looked at that data. So I'll have to pull that up.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a break. We'll be right back.
Like what you hear? Make sure you rate and subscribe. Three Black Docs is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Yay! Henrietta Lacks, 100 years old.
Wow.
Yes.
And her husband died in 2002.
Oh, really? So it was after this. Oh, it was right after the book came out, right?
No. Book came out in 2010, I think. Let's see. Did y'all really not like the book? I liked the book.
I could not get through it.
You couldn't?
Mm-mm.
Hmm. Okay, well, let's see. When did the book come out?
And, you know, didn't she get married when she was like 14?
Yeah, you're right, 2010.
Yes, 2010, yeah.
It's just fascinating. She got married when she was 14, had some kids, and died at 31. I mean, this is
31.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's
unbelievable.
So sad. But I'm glad her family has been recognized at least. And, you know, I think there's no way to quantify kind of really how much we really owe her in terms of how much progress has been made scientifically through the use of her cells.
Right.
But I do think it's important too, as Tiffany mentioned, we've really changed the way that science is done, at least in this country for the most part. And it's not to say there aren't things that happen that are a little crazy, whack, funky every once in a while, but.
Right. Like our discussion last week.
What?
With the journal about professionalism.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't research, though. Come on now, you know, don't get started on that.
But we had a platform then that, you know, Ash could link the New York Times article that came out about it, because we're timely. We're talking about the timely stuff in medicine.
Right. Yeah.
Like it or not.
But, you know, research is the way to move the needle forward in terms of medicine. But it's really important to know that there have been some important stopgaps that have been put in place that really protect participants in medical research.
So, right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so not only how much it, you know, medicine changes and the speed of it changes in terms of like treatments, but just that, like patient protection, right? And how research has changed so much in a relatively short amount of time too. So
yeah.
Right.
But that's why I tell people to have conversations with your doctors.
Oh, and, yeah. You know,
there's no way a primary care provider can keep up with this.
None whatsoever. But that was the big conversation on our call today. And how do we kind of ensure that primary care doctors who, and it's funny because they're stressed, right?
Yeah,
of course.
Primary care doctor was saying she has 19 minutes to see a new patient. I'm like,
that's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous. How do you do that? And then you have to go through all the check boxes in terms of, you know,
but you know, no,
and all that kind of stuff. The way we practice medicine in this country is
no. You know, I think at some point you just have to stand up because, you know, this is crazy. You can't see anyone in 19 minutes.
Nope,
not a new patient.
I mean, you can if you have MAs and other people taking most of the information, but I still don't think you can do a thorough job as a clinician, you know, for a primary care doctor.
Right. Yeah. And wash your hands and put on your gloves and cover up your stethoscope with a glove. Like, it's just too much.
Oh, it's too much. In the COVID era.
In the era of Corolla.
In the Corolla.
It's too much.
But actually, my partner, one of the partners and I were talking, we were talking about all the changes in medicine. And, you know, with new drugs that are coming out, it is insane the amount of new drugs that are coming out for all these different diseases.
Yeah.
I mean, there are drugs that, you know, I told one patient with MDS, I was like, you know what? I don't know. I really don't have anything after this drug that I have you on right now, which just was approved in April. Right. So I got it for him early. Mm-hmm. It was approved in April. Doesn't look like it's working. I was like, I don't know what else to do. So then a week later, a new MDS drug was approved. I didn't even know it was on the pipeline.
That is wild.
The drug company didn't even know it was going to get approved. Right. You know,
myelodysplastic syndrome, MDS. Is that what Robin, the newscaster Robin?
Yeah.
Has? Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But she got it from chemotherapy. Yeah.
But it's one of these kind of disorders where people can end up needing blood transfusions and all kinds
exactly.
of other things.
Exactly.
Cells afloat, but it's fascinating. And you guys would probably know this better than I thought that the heme malignancies were one of the fastest growing subspecialties in oncology in terms of new drug development, or at least FDA approvals.
Yes. Uh-huh. So absolutely. So myeloma got up and ran away with new drugs. And
yep.
still, I mean, even now, there are several new drugs for myeloma. Actually, there have been a lot of new drugs approved for even diffuse large B-cell lymphoma.
I was going to say lymphoma.
But what we were talking about, you know, we were just talking about all these new drugs and the side effects, right? So there are always these unique side effects. And keeping mm-hmm. up with all of these side effects is really hard because you have to do the chemotherapy education. There's no way a nurse can keep up with all of this. And then you need to try to keep it straight. So he was like, I really want to think of new ways for us to efficiently have these drugs and have a resource where we can get this information quickly, almost like kind of a crowdsourcing of information. Like, you know what, Karen, you were involved in this trial. You know everything about it. Mm-hmm. How can we quickly, efficiently say, okay, boom, here's the drug. Here's everything we need to do. All the side effects. Mm-hmm. To quickly tell the patient about it.
But see, here's the important part again about people knowing what's going on with you and your treatment. When the immunotherapies came out, right? Mm-hmm. That was a whole new set of side effects that were different from traditional chemotherapy. Okay.
Completely different.
So some places were give patients cards to keep in their wallets that say, I am getting this drug and, you know, here are the side effects and please call my oncologist with the immunotherapies. Because if you end up in an ER, maybe that's not, you know, where your oncologist is, maybe doesn't have so many cancer patients, you know, and you're on one of the newer drugs that has a whole different side effect profile and a different treat side effects, right? And needs an early intervention with steroids or whatever it is. So people have to know what you're on to know when to intervene. So again, you got to tell people what's going on in your family, right? In case you get sick. And to your point on our end of things, of how can we make it clear for patients so that if they do get into any sort of issue, that whatever the intervention is can be done and started quickly.
Also, yeah. Making sure that your oncologist is fully aware, right? Because like you said, you know, a lot of these drugs, they're coming. We're doing next generation sequencing, which is basically DNA testing on all of these different cancers. And, you know, there may be four or five new drugs that you can treat that are in different indications than what you would normally use.
Mm-hmm. That's why, again, it's so important to just know what you're on. As you say, Zanetta, you know, really knowing, writing down the names of the drugs and knowing what it is you're being treated with and why.
But I like the idea of having
that information. Right? Yeah.
Giving patients, particularly if it's a new patient. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I like that is, number one, because some of these names are so difficult to pronounce, even for clinicians.
Oh, yeah.
Ibtimabs, all of those have these long, drawn-out names. And because it's really hard even for clinicians to keep up. So if somebody has a card and they go to the emergency room and say, this is the medicine I'm on, they can even look it up. But the other reason why is because, as we know, a lot of these clinical trials are not inclusive. There's not diverse populations in the clinical
trials. So you're seeing new side effects.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly.
So in the post-marketing, you might see different things. Whereas you know, when the clinical trial was done, they may say, well, here are the most common side effects. And you're going to go through and you have a conversation with your patient and say, most common side effect is nausea, but we're going to take care of it with this medicine. But then this patient shows up with chest pain or some other thing that wasn't one of the normal indications or, you know, one of the normal, some of the side effects. It's because, you know, our clinical trials are not diverse enough oftentimes to kind of look at the whole, you know, cadre of individuals. And so that's why that post-marketing, you know, especially in the first couple of years, is really important to kind of do those analyses to look at side effects and toxicities. And it's great if we can help our patients, you know, by giving them a card or by writing it down for them or something and tell them to keep it on, that would be helpful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that post-marketing piece, Karen, is so true because first of all, it's diverse populations. But then if you think about it, a lot of the trials that lead to approvals, some of them have less than 1,000 patients treated with the drug. Okay.
Oh, so for MDS, you can have between 50 to 70 patients, easy.
Yeah. So now you have a clinical trial, right, of patients that are selected based on strict criteria to start off with. Okay. So you're already starting off with kind of a hand-picked sample, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you get, you know, might be 100, might be less than 100, you know, whatever the number is, and that drug gets approved, that's fine and dandy. You know, that's how things move ahead. But now you're introducing that into a not handpicked population of like normal, everyday, regular folks who have this disease. And so you are going to see, I think, other things come out when you extend it out to a larger population, more diverse, more comorbid conditions. So other conditions like maybe your trial was written to not include patients that have high blood pressure. But guess what? Now in the real world, people with high blood pressure are getting your meds. So now, like, what happens to them? So again, so important to keep up with what's happening, what drugs you're on and how you're feeling on them. Yeah.
Can I just say, though, I tell patients a lot, but like in my oncology lifetime, I've seen the standard of care change for so many different cancers, acute leukemia. There's a disease called CLL, multiple myeloma, even lung cancer.
Yes.
Like what I'm seeing with lung cancer.
Yeah.
It is fascinating. I mean, just to think, like, you know, seven, 8 years ago, melanoma.
Melanoma.
I mean, it really.
How many treatments did we learn about for metastatic melanoma? Two?
One.
I was going to say two.
I was like, really? Right. I don't know what
you're talking about. I mean, I was the one. Right.
You know, the landscape has changed so much. Yeah. That's what makes it exciting to be an oncologist. That's what makes us so optimistic, you know, when it comes to treating patients and telling people that, you know, things have gotten so much better and it's moving along so quickly.
I think I was on a call with the FDA or something like this, and there was a general, I think it was a general, he was either a general oncologist or might have been primary care doc, I can't remember, but he was throwing shade about people who go, who specialize. He was like, you know, there are some people who just really want to know just a little narrow piece of medicine. And, you know, some of us others, we like to know a lot about a lot. I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't want to be a generalist. I would not want to be a primary care doctor just for the reasons that Danetta just talked about, right? Primary care doctor has to understand hypertension and diabetes and all. And so you can imagine if there are, you know, 10 new drugs for each of those diseases, you know, that come out every year, just 10. For, you know, those two drugs, that's 20 drugs. You have to figure out toxicities and side effect profiles and go through things. It's hard. It's hard enough being an oncologist and specializing. I mean, you guys have to deal with a lot, especially with all of the new immunotherapeutics. And I still need to understand them as a radiation oncologist because I have to worry about when people get concurrent therapy, right? When
exactly.
They get radiation with chemotherapy. And I'm very highly conservative, as he will tell you. I'm not giving radiation therapy to somebody who's having something that I don't know anything about. And if there's no literature for it, I'm not doing it. And I know some of my colleagues get mad at me. It's like, well, it's a targeted agent. It is, you know, it shouldn't have any interaction. I said, it shouldn't, but we don't know.
Right.
Especially when we're talking about giving somebody treatment in their spine or a nerve or some other sensitive organ like the eye, I am not going to give concurrent radiation therapy unless I have good data to show me that it's safe. You know, I think it's hard. So I am so grateful I'm a specialist and I'm a sub specialist. And I'm happy. I'm so happy.
I am happy to be sub.
Happy.
I want to give a shout out to the primary care docs though, because in a lot of ways, I think they have like the hardest job.
Absolutely.
To be the gatekeeper for all that, for all of this stuff, you know.
And
we're just talking about
minutes.
Yes. And we're just talking about our stuff, cancer stuff. Like, they're the gatekeeper for everything, right? So. And shout out to the primary care docs.
Shout out to the primary care doctors.
Free Black Docs is not intended as medical advice. All opinions are our own. Free Black Docs is produced by Wings Productions.
Like what you hear? Make sure you rate and subscribe. Free Black Docs is available wherever you get your podcasts.